the white man uses these big guns or Negro leaders against the black revolution. They are not a part of the black revolution. They're used against the black revolution. When Martin Luther King failed to desegregate Albany, Georgia, the civil rights struggle in America reached its low point. King became bankrupt almost as a leader. Plus, even financially, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was in financial trouble. Plus, it was in trouble, period, with the people when they failed to desegregate Albany, Georgia. Other Negro civil rights leaders of so-called national stature became fallen idols. As they became fallen idols, began to lose their prestige and influence, local Negro leaders began to stir up the masses. In Cambridge, Maryland, Gloria Richardson. In Danville, Virginia, and other parts of the country, local leaders begin to stir up our people at the grassroots level. This was never done by these Negroes whom you recognize of national stature. They controlled you, but they never incited you or excited you. They controlled you. They contained you. They kept you on the plantation. As soon as King failed in Birmingham, Negroes took to the streets. King got out and went out to California to a big rally and raised about, I don't know how many thousands of dollars. Come to Detroit and had a march and raised some more thousands of dollars. And recall, right after that, Wilkins attacked King, accused King and the Corps of starting trouble everywhere and then making the NAACP get him out of jail and spend a lot of money, and then he accused King and Corps of raising all the money and not paying it back. This happened. I got it in documented evidence in the newspaper. Roy started attacking King, and King started attacking Roy, and Farmer started attacking both of them. And as these Negroes of national stature begin to attack each other, they begin to lose their control of the Negro masses. And Negroes was out there in the streets. They was talking about, we're going to march on Washington. By the way, and right at that time, Birmingham had exploded, and the Negroes in Birmingham, remember, they also exploded. They began to stab the crackers in the back and bust them upside the head. Yes, they did. That's when Kennedy sent in the troops down in Birmingham. So, and right after that, Kennedy got on the television and said, this is a moral issue. That's when he said he's going to put out a civil rights bill. And when he mentioned civil rights bill and the Southern crackers started talking about they were going to boycott it or filibuster it, then the Negroes started talking about what? We're going to march on Washington, march on the Senate, march on the White House, march on the Congress and tie it up, bring it to a halt. Don't let the government proceed. They even said they was going to go out to the airport and lay down on the runway and don't let no airplanes land. I'm telling you what they said. That was revolution. That was revolution. That was the black revolution. It was the grassroots out there in the street. Scared the white man to death. Scared the white power structure in Washington, D.C. to death. I was there. When they found out that this black steamroller was going to come down on the Capitol, they called in Wilkins. They called in Randolph. They called in these national Negro leaders that you respect and told them, call it off. Kennedy said, look, y'all letting this thing go too far. And old Tom said, boss, I can't stop it because I didn't start it. I'm telling you what they said. They said, I'm not even in it, much less at the head of it. They said, these Negroes are doing things on their own. They're running ahead of us. And that old shrewd fox, he said, well, if you all aren't in it, I'll put you in it. I'll put you at the head of it. I'll endorse it. I'll welcome it. I'll help it. I'll join it. A matter of hours went by. They had a meeting at the Carlisle Hotel in New York City. The Carlisle Hotel is owned by the Kennedy family. That's the hotel Kennedy spent the night at two nights ago. Belongs to his family. A philanthropic society headed by a white man named Stephen Currier called all the top civil rights leaders together at the Carlisle Hotel and told them that by you all fighting each other, you're destroying the civil rights movement. And since you're fighting over money from white liberals, let us set up what's known as the Council for United Civil Rights Leadership. Let's form this council, and all the civil rights organizations will belong to it. And we'll use it for fundraising purposes. Let me show you how tricky the white man is. And as soon as they got it formed, they elected Whitney Young as the chairman. And who you think became the co-chairman? Stephen Currier, the white man. A millionaire. Powell was talking about it down at the Cobo today. This is what he was talking about. Powell knows it happened. Randolph knows it happened. Wilkins knows it happened. King knows it happened. Every one of that so-called Big Six, they know what happened. Once they formed it, with the white man over it, he promised them and gave them $800,000 to split up between the Big Six and told them that after the march was over, they'd give them $700,000 more. $1.5 million split up between leaders that you've been following, going to jail for, crying crocodile tears for, and they've nothing but Frank James and Jesse James and what you call it, brothers. Soon as they got the setup organized, the white man made available to them top public relations experts. Opened the news media across the country at their disposal. And then they began to project these Big Six as the leaders of the march. Originally, they weren't even in the march. You was talking this march talk on Hastings Street. Is Hastings Street still here? On Hastings Street. You was talking the march talk on Lenox Avenue. And down on, Fillmore Street, and Central Avenue, and 42nd Street, and 63rd Street. That's where the march talk was being talked. But the white man put the Big Six ahead of it, made them the march. They became the march. They took it over. And the first move they made after they took it over, they invited Walter Reuther, a white man. They invited a priest. A rabbi and an old white preacher. Yes, an old white preacher. The same white element that put Kennedy in power, labor, the Catholics, the Jews, and liberal Protestants. Same clique that put Kennedy in power joined the March on Washington. It's just like when you got some coffee that's too black, which means it's too strong. What you do? You integrate it with cream. You make it weak. If you pour too much cream in, you won't even know you ever had coffee. It used to be hot, it becomes cool. It used to be strong, it becomes weak. It used to wake you up, now it'll put you to sleep. This is what they did with the March on Washington. They joined it. They didn't integrate it, they infiltrated it. They joined it, became a part of it, took it over. And as they took it over, it lost its militancy. They ceased to be angry. They ceased to be hot. They ceased to be uncompromising. Why, it even ceased to be a march. It became a picnic, a circus. Nothing but a circus with clowns and all. You had one right here in Detroit. I saw it on television with clowns leading it, white clowns and black clowns. I know you don't like what I'm saying, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Because I can prove what I'm saying. If you think I'm telling you wrong, you bring me Martin Luther King and H. Philip Randolph and James Farmer and those other three and see if they'll deny it over the microphone. No, it was a sellout. It was a takeover. When James Baldwin came in from Paris, they wouldn't let him talk because they couldn't make him go by the script. Burt Lancaster wrote the speech that Baldwin was supposed to make. They wouldn't let Baldwin get up there because they know Baldwin liable to say anything. They controlled it so tight, they told those Negroes what time to hit town, how to come, where to stop, what sign to carry, what song to sing, what speech they could make and what speech they couldn't make, and then told them to get out of town by sundown. And every one of those toms were out of town by sundown. Now, I know you don't like my saying this, but I can back it up. It was a circus, a performance. It beat anything Hollywood could ever do. The performance of the year. Reuther and those other three devils should get an Academy Award for the best actors because they acted like they really loved Negroes and fooled a whole lot of Negroes. And the six Negro leaders should get an award, too, for the best supporting cast.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your money when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Vladimir Deese, and welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast, addendum to episode 32. Who was Martin Luther King? As a studier of Martin Luther King and a man who really, really enjoys what he says, what he does, or what he did, excuse me. I have been contemplating for a few years the following reality. That Martin Luther King was both a pawn and an establishment figure. Let me explain this. My inspiration for this comes from Malcolm X, hence the reason why I started this clip off like I did. And, of course, X maintained for many of his early months of fame, which, you know, it's always shocks me how many months he actually was on the national scene, far less longer than Martin Luther King, yet he had a dramatic following that was very, very dedicated. he said that Martin Luther King was one of these, quote, Negro leaders that excited you, but never incited you. And being a person who also loves Malcolm X, who can't get enough of Malcolm X, I love his speaking style, I love his in-your-faceness, I love everything about Malcolm X, just like I love everything about Martin Luther King. That struck me as odd, especially because in his latter years, Malcolm really had evolved and started saying to people, I mean, this was specifically, basically right before he died, you need to give everything to Martin Luther King that he asks for. That's what he said. And so this idea, this notion of Martin Luther King being some kind of a pawn, being an establishment leader, was very hard for me to take. Of course, that was hard for me to take before I knew who Martin Luther King really was. This is not one of those times when I'm going to come to you and say, oh, well, Martin Luther King was an FBI this, he was a snitch, he was a that. This is not one of those commentaries because I don't believe that. But Martin Luther King, I believe, was a pawn for a while until he became less of a pawn because he started speaking some stuff that rich people did not like. My theory from this comes from understanding the civil rights movement. And the fact that I have been listening and reading things for the last few years about the civil rights movement, that has really piqued my interest. One such thing is, it was brought out by Jeremiah Wright, ironically, it is the fact that the NAACP helped to organize, was the primary organizer in the Montgomery bus boycott. They were the primary organizer, not SCLC. SCLC, which I knew this ironically, wasn't created till after the boycott. It was created after the boycott because the Southern Christian Baptists and just basically the Southern Christians wanted a organization to work within to coordinate their efforts down south. Well, this is an interesting notion to actually have, or a notion to actually know, because then you got to ask the question, well, wait a minute. SCLC started with, I think it was over 100 ministers. So this was a lot of churches in the South. Usually, people who do that, you know, you get, which, I mean, they did, bomb threats and everything like that. I mean, especially in that era. But who was backing them? And this was something that Malcolm X continued to ask. Who was backing them? Well, if you read books by former King associates, you know, I have one called What Would Martin Say, where the author specifically mentions going to New York and having, I guess it was the Rockefellers, literally open up the vault and give him money. The only way that that happens is if you are an establishment accomplice. Now, that doesn't mean that Martin Luther King knew about this. Indeed, when you get to the COINTEL program papers, you realize that the FBI and, you know, definitely the FBI, but probably more notably the CIA, the DIA, the MIA, these are alphabet security agencies, may I say, talked about removing King as a leader and placing another person in his position. When that person was talked to about this, well, they said they knew nothing about it. If we take their word at face value and say they knew nothing about it, what that suggests then is that the power structure utilizes leaders, will promote certain people and demote other people. So, you know, and ironically, I have the same question about Malcolm X, which, you know, he rose pretty quickly. And it is my belief, truthfully, that Malcolm X also, which, you know, this is a very, very, unpopular thing to say, but I think he was also a pawn for a while, but he didn't realize it. He was a pawn to keep Martin Luther King humble. And it was easy to spin him as a threat. So, you know, he was unlikely to get tons of white support. But you use him to buffer King, to force King to be more conservative with his message. Because if you push too fast, well, here's this other guy who you can start to be compared to. And if you're compared to him, you're going to start to lose all of your support. So Malcolm X was used to buffer King. You know, the Mike Wallace piece, you know, the hate that hate spawned or something like that from the 60s, where they were talking about the black Muslims as this hate group, was a great way of introducing Malcolm X as the anti-King, and to really place him into the consciousness of all of America, and then, you know, to allow the American people to see the contrasting styles and say, look, we're going to have some kind of change. You know, this is the establishment talking to them. We're going to have some kind of change. The question is, do you want these people leading it, Malcolm X, or do you want this friendly-looking black person leading it, Martin Luther King? So Martin and Malcolm, I think, in some ways, were pawns in this game. You know, and the ultimate game, ironically, was to bring down segregation in the South, the old layer of segregation, enabling kind of this new layer of segregation to, you know, prop up or pop up, but I'm not going to really discuss that right now. So Martin Luther King, in the late 50s, was going around giving all of these great speeches about racism and about race relations. So he was building up his statue in the public's eye, and he would make off mentions and comments about, you know, various other issues that might tie into racism. But he was a very conservative man in those days. I mean, most of his speeches are not splashy. And indeed, I think when he was elevated to the president position in the SCLC, and then he was given a staff, like, you notice the evolution of some of his speeches, to be honest with you. Whereas before, they were structured, but they were also unstructured. They were very personable. And I never realized this until I started listening to some of his earlier speeches. King had a marvelous sense of humor. Specifically, there's this one called What the Negro Can Learn from History. And you see it in this speech, just his marvelous sense of humor. And that was something that was kind of lost as time went on. And I think as the establishment kind of molded him, he became more serious. He became more serious. Like, he would quote, God, I can't even remember, Carson from The Tonight Show. And he would use that statement a lot, you know, a long time, actually, past when he should have used it. And it just wasn't, it didn't feel as genuine as some of the earlier stuff that he said that was really funny. But he taught patience, and this isn't a bad thing, but he taught patience in the face of crisis. And he did this I don't really truthfully believe he was getting orders from the top, but he did this because he understood that it, you know, would take time, but he didn't want to push too fast, and this is one thing that Malcolm X did point out, and that was to not make the white establishment afraid. Now, being the type of pawn that he was, you know, this was really, he didn't realize it until later on, I think, that he was a pawn. He was given access to the president. I mean, Malcolm X was never going to go and meet with the president. Most people were not going to go and meet with the president. A. Philip Randolph got to meet with the president, but didn't have the kind of influence that Martin Luther King had. He was able to access institutions that other black leaders had never been able to access. I mean, for God's sakes, a black leader having the Rockefellers fund them. You know, that's a huge deal. Having all of these liberal, which is just a code name for institutional structures, fund them. The newspapers were glowing about this preacher, this young preacher, this black preacher with this nonviolence rhetoric. You know, absolutely, this man was an establishment guy, but he didn't know it. How can you tell he didn't know it? Because Martin Luther King made a mistake. He believed what he was being told about changing America. I believe all of the pastors and individuals within the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which, may I say, in hindsight, that limited the responsibility, and I mean that as in two words, responsibility, ability to respond to the crises that was unfolding in the nation of the SCLC. Now, before I get back into more heavily how he made his mistake and what really says to you that he didn't understand, that he was just a pawn in all this, let me say first that the SCLC was meant to counter not Malcolm X, but the NAACP. Why? Because the NAACP is a spiritual and religious tradition organization. Meaning they do not base their philosophy on Christianity any more than they base it on Islam, Buddhism, and probably atheism too. I think atheism would probably fit in there too. Their chief religion is liberation and freedom. It is about, as Jeremiah Wright said, reconciliation. It is about the worth of all of God's children. Imagine if you had, and by the way, at this time, the NAACP was not folded into the institutional structure like they are now. The NAACP is, you know, it's tragic how basically inept the organization is. But they were not folded into the institutional structure. They were very much, they were more independent than the Urban League. The Urban League, which really it's tragic to say it, but the Urban League didn't have any real influence in the civil rights movement, which is tragic again. And I think Malcolm X had been contemplating trying to start an organization that would combat the Urban League. The Urban League, if you read, I can't think of the book title now, unfortunately, but I think you can research this anyway. The Urban League, by the 50s, by the actual 40s, had been basically infiltrated to the highest level by the FBI They controlled the head guy of the Urban League. So the Urban League had no influence. The NAACP was not there yet. And I believe, unfortunately, the NAACP is there today. The NAACP does not move agenda anymore. They're powerless. And I believe that they've been infiltrated. This is what the FBI and CIA do. They infiltrate organizations like this. They take them over. And then they disempower them. So, SCLC was meant to combat the NAACP's wide appeals. Because with the right leader, and if Martin Luther King had not started SCLC, but went to the NAACP to head that up, think about the philosophy that he would have employed from people. The ecumenicality, which he started speaking about later on publicly in Beyond Vietnam. Imagine what it would have been like to have him speak about the ecumenicality from 1957 onward. Or 1955 onward. Or 1960s. Or 1960 onward. So that was, they were there, I believe, to combat the NAACP. Now, back to his mistake. Why, you know, King was really a believer. He was a believer in what he was saying. So it was not a big deal to him to move from civil rights, which, you know, voting rights and such down south, to human rights. And in 1964, as the problems in the inner cities started really attracting national attention, and Malcolm X was tempering some of his fiery language and saying, you know something, we need to listen more to Martin Luther King. I think he's right. And making overtures to meeting with King and trying to get the two movements together. King was at a crossroads. Because King had been talking passionately about, you know, equality. And now he was being confronted not with Southern poverty and segregation, but an issue that he didn't know much about, which was Northern poverty and segregation. So he had many people around him who were advising him about a number of topics, whether it was labor unions, civil rights, or what have you. But he really didn't have that many people around him talking with him about the Northern ghetto, segregation, and poverty. So to get together with Malcolm X would have been a huge deal. And King, even before Malcolm X was assassinated, was starting to talk more openly about the problems of the North. And everybody pretty much realizes that Malcolm X was killed to stop him and King from detenting, from coming together. That would have been, you know, like I had pointed out before, well, that would have been tragic because you wouldn't have been able to. That was a force that was basically unstoppable. You know, as I said, it's my belief that Malcolm X was elevated to keep King humble. Well, now King was starting to see what X had been talking about since 1961. And he was starting to make many of the connections that X had already made. So he was standing there saying, oh my God, I see all this. Something has to be done about this. Well, I don't really have the institutional structures to go into the inner cities. I don't have the influence to go into the inner cities. I'm going to need somebody, some people, who do. Who can I turn to? Malcolm X is killed. Malcolm X is killed. You know, you have to wonder when Malcolm X was killed if Martin Luther King looked in the mirror and realized that he was now the leader of what had essentially been two movements. Within a year of Malcolm X's death, I think it was a little bit more than a year, King was already, you know, going hard, as we would say today, going hard at poverty in the North. And this is where he hit that brick wall, where the liberal institutions showed their true colors. As soon as he started talking about domestic poverty and started talking about the war in Vietnam, 66, 67, the liberal institutions started retracting their money, pulling it back, and trying to keep him on their leash. As Mumia points out, when King came out against the Vietnam War, he was a marked man. The FBI memos say he's a marked man. He's a marked man. But more specifically, they told him he was a marked man. This goes into the whole point with the pawn thing. This is the first thing that really hit me about what Malcolm X was saying about King being a pawn. A day after King came out about the Vietnam War, the New York Times ran an op-ed which stated, you know, I've never been able to read this, but I've heard it from several sources, including, you know, it's on the Marvelous documentary, not as marvelous anymore because I know so much more about the time period, the Civil Rights Movement, but Eyes on the Prize. And it was said in the New York Times that Martin Luther King had outlived his usefulness. You know, that he was basically, he had overstayed his welcome. And I think, you know, if King had read that, you have to realize that. I'm thinking he realized. I mean, I realize it now, so the man was much more in tune than I am, that he not only was a marked man, but they were telling him, we're going to get you. And I wonder if it dawned on him then, you know, I'm wondering even if it had dawned on him earlier that he was only meant to bring down the segregation system in the South. If you, historically, King is a leader from the late 50s to about 63. Maybe even to the early part of 65. And then you lose track of him, right? If you look at what he was saying, the end of 65 into 66, 67, what you realize is one thing. King was becoming disillusioned with the institutions that had originally supported him. King talked about the weakness of the Civil Rights Bill. There is a great speech that up until now was not released to the general public. And, you know, I can kind of understand why. The rough draft of it is pretty crude. There's some mistakes, should I say, not a lot, but there are some mistakes. It's a speech that I had seen referenced in several academic books. It's called The Speech from Fogmore, South Carolina. You can find it on the King Center's archives. There's also, and unfortunately they don't have the whole speech that I'm about to talk about here, or that I'm about to mention here. They don't have the whole one anyway. It's a speech it's a presentation for the Democratic National Committee from 1964. And there's two versions of it. There's the version which he gave, which I don't, you know, which was decent. But then there's another one, which is what he wrote. The, you know, it was his rough draft. And in that speech, he talks about, in both of those speeches actually, he talks about the weakness of the Civil Rights Bill and some of the things that could have been done, specifically in the one that he was going to give to the Democratic National Committee. What could have been done to strengthen it. But he also talks about in the Frogmore speech, he also talks about the institutional problems of the United States and how really transforming the nation is going to pit them, SCLC, up against the captains of industry. Now, understand this. This speech was given, I think it was 66. And by late 67, actually they were starting to experience it then, SCLC had had its funds cut off by just about every institutional lender that had been supporting it previously. You know, King stated on several occasions that he didn't make statements based on the budget of the SCLC. And that statement is a broad-reaching declaration saying, you don't own me. I am not on your leash. Whereas, I believe the institutions thought he was. Now, this is when he broke from that pawn status, and this is when the media started downplaying his involvement in the civil rights movement. This is when the media started hyping up the more, not even radical, because I hate that word, but some of the more violent. And I can't even say violent, because some of these people, it wasn't that they were violent by choice, they were defending themselves. But some more of the kind of Malcolm X 2.0 radicals, right? And they played these people up to the point of getting Americans into a frenzy. The Americans became afraid of the civil rights movement. And so then you have the white backlash. And again, all of this is being orchestrated. Now you're going, well, wait a minute. How do you know this? Where's your proof? Well, these people aren't stupid. They don't go out there and write a book and say, hey, this is how we played you dumbass Americans. No, it's all about looking at the story and seeing the reality underneath it. And seeing how things fit together. There's a book that I have called Television, the Cultural Something. And it really speaks to how television is used to create the image or the images that we perceive in culture or in the culture. And it's called The Citizen Machine, so I was kind of far off. And, you know, there's another book that I have called Culture Inc., which, again, all of this is just, it's all talking about this. You know? And truthfully, if you just read Edward Bernays' Propaganda, the book The Society as Spectacle, all of those books touch on this theme. So, you have kind of the foundation work coming together for Martin Luther King to be pushed aside as a leader. And, you know, at the same time, 66, 65, you start hearing about the, quote, white backlash, which is, you know, white people are saying, oh, well, you're moving too fast, you know, for us. So now they're starting to get up in arms and they're voting for Republicans and conservatives and all of this nonsense. And, yeah, you notice how I just said that, right? Republicans and conservatives, because the conservatives were the ones who were trying to keep the status quo. I don't care if you don't like the notion. That is the definition of a conservative. You want the status quo. I don't care how neoconservatives have tried to spin it. A conservative wants the status quo. At the same time, you had supposedly liberal institutions, and actually they were liberal institutions. You know, Martin Luther King made a note on one of his books in the 40s that the problem with liberals were they were not only center of the road, but they didn't really act on much. And so you had liberal institutions at the same time that this new tide of conservatism was rising, you had liberal institutions strangling SCLC and other organizations who dared to come out and speak with passion about the true problems of the day. Martin Luther King, the pawn, was essentially dead by 66. By specifically, I'd say the end of 66. And when he came out against the Vietnam War, a lot of people say, oh, well, he broke with Lyndon Johnson. King didn't only break with Lyndon Johnson. King broke with every liberal institution. By the end of, or every liberal institution that had essentially supported them, very few remained. There were all of these questions, and it amazed me. There were all of these questions in the late 60s and 67 specifically about the budget of the SCLC. And what most people don't understand is that's the way of the reporter who's on the inside of saying, hey, don't you think you're going a little bit too far now? I mean, these people are taking away money. I mean, that's all that really matters, isn't it? Money. And King kept saying, I don't make statements based on the budget of the SCLC. Now, they had abandoned him. I mean, they were gone. And what was amazing was, during this time period, you saw King start to embrace some of the people, you know, which he probably considered more level-headed, from Malcolm X's camp, people like Ossie Davis, you know, and other people. And this evolved his rhetoric. I mean, he became a black power advocate to the greatest and fullest extent. And it was really beautiful to hear him talk about it. But let me press on here, because I didn't expect to be talking this long, but this is something that I've really been thinking about and going over in my head for a while and just, you know, making notes about. So the last part of this, which really points to his pawnness, doesn't ironically start with King, but starts with A. Philip Randolph. A. Philip Randolph is one of those individuals who I don't know all that much about. I'm just learning about the man. And he was a black unionist, a black union leader, and was really considered kind of radical. I mean, he had unionized, I think it was the streetcars, porters. And, you know, he had been really pushing for a Washington march for a long time. And if what I'm reading is correct about him, in his heyday, you know, he was really kind of more of a cross between Malcolm and Martin. He was really radical. Which, by the way, may I say, you know, research Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks was actually a pretty radical figure. It was amazing. But he was pretty radical, and he really was passionate about liberty and freedom. I mean, real liberty and freedom for the underprivileged. And he had been pushing for a march on Washington for about 30 or 40 years, when the establishment had blocked him constantly, just blocked him. And then finally, you know, with Martin Luther King, this, you know, again, pawn. May I say this doesn't diminish who Martin Luther King was, but it's good to have this reality check. With Martin Luther King at the helm of this, and this again, this goes back to Malcolm X. Malcolm X turned me on to this. With Martin Luther King at the helm of it and some of these other more conservative black leaders at the helm of it, the March on Washington was given a green light. You know, the establishment, as Malcolm X said, invited them in, told them where they can march, what signs to hold, and then what time to be out of the Capitol. Right? When you look at the speeches that were given that day, you know, John Lewis speaks about this. He wanted to give a speech that was very much more aligned with the feeling of the youth that day. And this, by the way, gets into culture, pop culture specifically, and what pop culture does to us to suppress the internal urges to be radical, to fix the problems at our, you know, that exist in our time. But he was told no. You know, various people, and, you know, to John Lewis's credit, he said, I'm not listening to you. But various people in the organizations that were holding the March on Washington said, no, you can't take a radical position there. And John Lewis said, well, we're the youth. We need to take a radical position, and we're going to take a radical position. And only when A. Philip Randolph contacted him and said, hey, I've been looking for this for 30, 40 years, man, please, did he change his words. That's when John Lewis changed his words. That's when John Lewis changed his words. Now, this is important. This is important. Why is it important? Because it tells you right now that the March on Washington was a stage. It was a stage. And it was a stage to kind of say to white folks, European Americans, hey, look at how orderly these people can be. And I mean, all they're asking for is Southern freedom. Now, the complex of the North is the South has all the problems. The North does not have any problems. So this worked. You know, overwhelmingly, European Americans, well, okay, not overwhelmingly, actually, minority still, were like, yo, you know, yeah, we should give them some rights, you know. And if it wasn't for Bull Connor, you know, unfortunately, I don't know if the rights would have even happened in 65 when they did. But the point is, later on when King started organizing a new March on Washington, which mirrored what Malcolm X had been talking about, the March on Washington, which he was talking about. And if you don't know about it, Google it. Malcolm X and March on Washington, and read what Malcolm X was actually saying about the March on Washington. The March on Washington didn't start with Martin Luther King and A. Philip Randolph. Oh, no. It started in the inner cities. You know, people were very disgusted and said, hey, we're going to march on Washington. And that's when, the institutions were like, no. We want these guys at the helm of it. So Martin Luther King, now, who had, you know, thrown off these shackles from these liberal institutions, said, hey, we're going to have another march on Washington. And we're going to hold it the latter part of April, 1968. And we're going to address poverty and school segregation, which was still an issue then and is today. We're going to address the issues of housing, the issues of hunger. And he was going around the nation gathering support for this March on Washington. And by all accounts, this was going to be a hell of a march. Hell of a march. And they said, no, we cannot allow him to do this. We cannot. the people who had been his puppet masters in opening all of the blinds so people could see Martin Luther King were trying to shut him down. Now, this is more aptly demonstrated by the fact that SCLC had started, I think it was in 1966, maybe 65, but I think 66. Yep, it was 66. The Operation Breadbasket. Now, when polls were taken, and I got this information, I was able to glean this off of the King Center archives. When polls were taken in 1968, asking then Negro youth, you know, have you heard about Martin Luther King's Operation Breadbasket? The majority apparently said no. You know something? I have no reason to doubt that, but then again, I do have a reason to doubt it because of what I just said about the media being in bed with the institutions that were, you know, trying to keep King a pawn. But, you know, if you know anything about polling, basically, as Noam Chomsky says, the polls are a way to take our pulse to see if what they're doing to us works and is working. You know, if their actions are having the desired effect. And assuming that this poll is correct, what this says is that they were saying, okay, we have minimized King. We have minimized King as a leader. We've minimized him completely. So, now we can move on to eliminating him as a leader. Well, I don't know if that poll was so accurate because, hey, King was murdered and 100 cities went up. Now, they killed King so he wouldn't march on Washington. Because if he had marched on Washington, the dynamics of the nation would have changed dramatically. You know, don't forget at this time, King also had the support of many middle-class leftists who were tied into the Vietnam War protests, but now we're also seeing how war and poverty and racism played a dramatic symphony, you know, in the part of the American musical. And so he's murdered. The mark, truthfully, of the institutions come into play after he's murdered. And this is with Jesse Jackson. And Jesse Jackson becomes the de facto leader. Not because SCLC makes him the de facto leader. But because right after the murders, Jesse Jackson is flown, excuse me, up to New York to appear on Today. Immediately, Jesse Jackson now is given the mantle of being the heir apparent of Dr. King. Even if SCLC, which, you know, I haven't been able to find any information on this, had said, oh, no, Abernathy or this other person is going to be the heir apparent, it would have probably caused a split within SCLC, destroying the structure, and it would have also caused a split among Americans, because you know the media would have played that up. The media would have played that up. Now, it is amazing that, you know, Reverend Jackson, I don't know, I'm not exactly sure how long it was before he left SCLC, but if what I'm reading is correctly, he was forced out, you know. He was forced out. And SCLC basically just languished along, you know, after King. But that was the last kind of major play that I want to talk about there, you know, that King out of the way, insert Jesse Jackson. And Jesse Jackson has been riding that wave for the last 40 years or so. And it's a shame because I think Jesse Jackson has some nice things to say, but what has Jesse Jackson really accomplished? What has Jesse Jackson really accomplished? Nothing. And he wasn't meant to accomplish anything. None of these black leaders today are meant to accomplish anything. Whether it is Barack Obama, who it frustrates me how many black people love this man, when I keep looking at him and saying, what has he done for you? What has he done for you? What does he do for you? Actually, any time when he is asked about race, he says, I'm the president of all people. Well, okay, that means you are the president of black people. Talk about black issues. Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, what have they done? What have they done? It's bad now, you know. The leaders, the true black leaders, are not the ones on the evening news, and those are the ones with the most high profile, unfortunately. But I'm hoping you enjoyed that. I know it was a bit rambling, and it was longer than most addendums. This could have been an episode by itself, but hey, whatever. You can contact me via classwarbattlefield@live.com. This is Vymir Dees saying, stay strong, my people. Stay strong. Hey, and remember this. I still am a great admirer of Dr. King. I do not fault him for what ultimately happened. What happened was, you know, he got caught in a system which he didn't understand. And it happens. The system is like that. I think, unfortunately, we have too many instances in the recent past. I think Tupac Shakur and Notorious B.I.G. were also, likewise, puppets who didn't understand fully their role and paid for it. What can you do, right? You know, we're coming to an age where things are changing, and things are going to change, and, you know, these individuals, I think, are, you know, they're not going away, but, you know, there's going to be changes. That's all I guess I can say right now. All right. Again, contact me at classwarbattlefield@live.com. This is Vymir Dees. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lives in the balance. Thank you.